As America begins the celebration of its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum thought it would be appropriate to create our own recognition of this important milestone. Welcome to Vashon 250, a look back at what was happening in America 250 years ago and comparing it to what has happened over the past 250 years of American history, what is happening in our current political life, and how these ideals and events have been reflected in the history of our own Vashon Island. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Hallman.
Thanks, John. Our approach to Vashon 250 during this 250th year of the United States of America as an independent nation uses the Declaration of Independence as an aspirational mission statement, the Constitution as a working user's manual, and the events of the American Revolution as a guide to help us understand who we are as a nation, how we came to be who we are, and how Vashon Island fits into this larger narrative structure.
Today we are looking at Patrick Henry's famous March 23rd, 1775 speech, "Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death." Patrick was a fiery orator from Virginia who spoke at the Second Virginia Convention that selected delegates to the Continental Congress and sent Virginia troops to battle. Patrick Henry responded to the Stamp Act with a series of resolutions introduced to the Virginia legislature in a speech. The Virginia resolves that we discussed during our fourth show on February 24th were adopted by the Virginia legislature and continued to articulate the American colony's opposition to British overreach. Henry helped draft the Virginia Constitution, the Virginia Declaration of Rights, and served as Virginia's first governor.
After the Revolution, Patrick Henry was an outspoken anti-federalist, so he opposed the ratification of the U.S. Constitution, which he felt put too much power in the hands of a national government. He influenced the creation of the Bill of Rights, which was based on the Virginia Declaration of Rights, that guaranteed personal freedoms, set limits on government's constitutional power. Patrick Henry was a slaveholder who opposed the importation of slaves, so he looked toward the ending of slavery. But when he died, he owned 67 slaves that he left to his wife and his sons.
The Give Me Liberty speech, which was not written down until about 1817, and as a result, historians question the accuracy of the written speech. It has, however, become part of the mythos of the American Revolution. As an interesting side note, Ken Burns, in his recent American Revolution program on PBS, it was the first one he'd done that didn't have contemporary recordings, visuals, so they had to kind of make stuff up a little bit. Or use paintings, pictures of landscapes, etc. So it is interesting to have to go back and look at some of these things and know that it's hard to verify their accuracy. But with that, let's begin. "This is no time for ceremony. The question before the House is one of awful moment to this country. For my own part, I consider it as nothing less than a question of freedom or slavery. This is no time for ceremony. The question before the House..." "The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but for me, give me the liberty or give me death."
So, Patrick Henry... was a slave owner. You know, he was an orator. He was heavily influenced by the Great Awakening of the 1730s, which was a revival of religious sort of fever during the 1730s and swept through America, also swept through England and Europe. His uncle was a minister. He grew up in that sort of sense of how important rhetoric from the pulpit was, And his speech to the Virginia Convention at this point really was a call to arms. And whether or not, I mean, many historians doubt whether or not he actually said the words, give me liberty or give me death. He certainly, from his other writings, implied that. But it becomes part of the myth of the American Revolution. It becomes a very important statement of the fever with which Americans approach the coming of the American Revolution.
So, Bruce, there are numerous events over the next 250 years of American history that echo these events. Let's start with the Sojourner Truth of 1851.
Yeah, I mean, you could go back and pick up speeches all through American history, and there's some just great sort of speeches. But what I tried to do here was pick a few that sort of capture the spirit of the times and that become turning points, if you will, in American history. And one of those is Sojourner Truth. Sojourner Truth, of course, a freed slave woman in 1851 gave the speech, a very short speech, entitled Ain't I a Woman? And it's important because it sort of articulates two of the great movements of the middle of the 19th century, of the 1850s and 1860s, the abolition movement and the suffrage movement, the women's rights movement. And what Sojourner Truth says is, if the first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, these women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it right side up again. Now they is asking to do it, and men better let them.
So then we move down the road a couple of years, and Frederick Douglass speaks about the hypocrisy of American slavery. I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged, in the name of liberty, which is fettered, in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce, with all the emphasis I can command, everything that serves to perpetuate slavery.
I mean, these are, when you listen to Sojourner Truth and to Frederick Douglass, I mean, what you get is a sense of the power of these movements, of the women's movement of the middle of the 19th century and of the abolition movement that really spurs and provides sort of the emotional inspiration behind the American Civil War. And all of that comes together, I think, in the Gettysburg Address by Abraham Lincoln in 1863. And in it, Lincoln says, at the conclusion, it's a very short speech. It's only a little over 2 minutes, but they are some of the most powerful words ever spoken in American history. And at the conclusion, you know, this is a dedication of a cemetery of those killed at the Battle of Gettysburg. He said, it is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we are here highly resolved that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Those are stirring words, and what they do is they take us back to the words that we'll talk about later in the show with the Declaration of Independence, in that sense that all men are created people, equal, and that governments are instituted among people, basically, to provide for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
We jump ahead to 1873 and Susan B. Anthony. Is it a crime for a citizen of the United States to vote? And other speeches. She speaks. We ask justice, we ask equality, we ask that all civil and political rights that belong to the citizens of the United States be guaranteed to us and our daughters forever. It was we, the people, not we, the white male citizens, nor yet we, the male citizens, but we, the whole people who formed the Union. Men, their rights and nothing more. Women, their rights and nothing less. Organize, agitate, educate must be our war cry.
Susan B. Anthony's just a fascinating figure because she's, in effect, stands in both the abolition movement prior to the Civil War, and then after the Civil War, and it becomes an advocate for the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that sort of abolish slavery and provide for the rights of U.S. citizens to vote. And what she is, she's basically taken to trial for having voted in the presidential election when women were not allowed to vote. And so this speech, is it a crime for citizens of the United States to vote? Is she's making that universal declaration that all people should have the right to vote. And then we come into the 1890s with William Jennings Bryan and the Cross of Gold speech. And again, this is in the 1890s. It's in the midst of a Great Depression, the most serious depression we've had in the United States prior to the Great Depression of the 1930s. Farmers are rising up to protest the loss of the value of their crops. Labor unions are beginning to emerge in the 1870s and 1880s. Labor strikes begin to rock the country in the 1890s and into the early part of the 20th century. And William Jennings Bryan, who is an unsuccessful candidate for the presidency, gives a speech in which he says, "We shall answer the demands for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." What, in effect, the United States doing was using the gold standard basically to keep prices down. And what labor was asking for, what farmers were asking for, is to move off of the gold standard, which ultimately happens, beginning in the 1930s and then ultimately legally in the 1970s under Richard Nixon. What you get is an attempt to begin to replace a gold standard with silver at this time in the 1890s. And then today, basically the American dollar has become the standard of world currencies, at least for now.
And then we look to Franklin Delano Roosevelt from his 1933 inauguration. He spoke those famous words, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Jump ahead to 1941 at his inauguration. In the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way, everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants, everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world. That is no vision of a distant millennium. It is a definite basis for a kind of world attainable in our own time and generation. That kind of world is the very antithesis of the so-called new order of tyranny, which the dictators seek to create with a crash of a bomb.
important to step back and see that FDR is making his Four Freedoms speech just before the United States enters World War II. So World War II is raging in Europe. It's raging in the Pacific, but the United States has stayed out of it. And, you know, within, what, 6-7 months, by December 1941, with Pearl Harbor, the United States would become part of that global struggle. But what FDR is doing here is articulating the world that people wanted to create and leaders around the world wanted to create after World War II. It becomes the basis for the United Nations. It becomes the basis for NATO and CETO and CENTO, the kinds of treaties that the United States forms around the world to contain communism, but also to establish, you know, a basically peaceful order in the world. And so it's really a speech that I think looks to the future and looks to establishing a sort of world structure that will prevent World War II's and World War II's and I from ever happening again, and establishing what becomes often called Pax Americana, sort of a period of almost 60 years after World War II in which major world wars are avoided. And then, of course, we come to 1961 with John F. Kennedy and sort of an emerging new sense of your responsibilities as citizens. And John F. Kennedy's inaugural speech, where he says, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." And it was an inspirational call to young people. And JFK had this incredible ability to speak to young people in the 1960s and to touch the sort of idealism that drove young people in the 1960s and that ultimately led to the Cultural Revolution later in the 1960s and led to the anti-war movement. And that sense of looking beyond themselves and beyond their own personal needs and looking to the needs of the whole.
And Kennedy's inspirational comment there led a whole generation of people to get involved in our communities in new and different ways through nonprofits, social services. The Peace Corps came directly out of the Kennedy administration. Later on with Clinton, we had the AmeriCorps program develop. And personally, I would argue that that inspirational feeling of ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, is something we need to hear more and more today. We certainly have the protests, and that's one part of it. But when you have to roll up your sleeves and get involved in things, that's a huge deal. And then we take that a step further and then look at the 1963 address from Martin Luther King, "I Have a Dream." And he says, "I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And when this happens, and when we allow freedom to ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, we'll be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, 'Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.'"
And that Martin Luther King sort of speech is sort of, you know, sort of the inspiration and motivation behind much of the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Yet there's also another side of that that comes out with Malcolm X, who is a contemporary of Martin Luther King. And in the late 60s, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Malcolm X, and the assassination of RF Kennedy deeply shake American politics. And what Malcolm X says in response, in effect, in 1964, to the Martin Luther King speech, is a phrase that says, "This is why I say it's the ballot or the bullet. It's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody." And this takes us back to what we had talked about last week with Patrick Henry's speech of "Give me liberty or give me death." And it gives you a sort of different spin on Martin Luther King's approach to the civil rights movement, is looking to a future that all people are free and all people are judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And Malcolm X is saying, it takes real change, and real change will come either through the ballot or through bullets.
So in looking at these various speeches from the 20th century, we focused on the great speeches that represent turning points in American history. What are some of the great turning point speeches of the 21st century, Bruce?
Well, of course, early on with 9/11, you have George Bush, speech the sort of next day, and he said, "This is a day," this is quoting George Bush, "this is a day when all Americans from every walk of life unite in our resolve for justice and peace. America has stood down enemies before, and we will do so this time. None of us will ever forget this day, yet we go forward to defend freedom and all that is good and just in our world." And of course, this devolves into, the invasion of Iraq, the Afghanistan war. I mean, it does not turn out to be this great battle for freedom that George Bush saw it as being. And yet 9/11 itself is one of those calls to action, much like Patrick Henry's speech.
And Al Gore spoke at a Nobel lecture in 2007. "We, the human species, are confronting a planetary emergency, a threat to the survival of our civilization that is gathering ominous and destructive potential, even as we gather here. But there is hopeful news as well. We have the ability to solve the crisis and avoid the worst, though not all, of its consequences, if we act boldly, decisively, and quickly. We are what is wrong, and we must make it right." He was speaking about his thoughts on the environment and global change, that sort of thing. Where that has gone is hard to say, although we continue to make efforts at improving our life.
It seems to have been devolving away from that grand sort of vision.
Yes.
Particularly in the last 5 or 6 years, as the United States has retreated from the Paris Accords and from being a leader in sort of the environmental movement to becoming one of the more regressive forces in the environment at this point. So, that's the sort of irony, if you will, of great speeches. I mean, they can present great aspirations, but they often, fail. Just as George Bush's vision for, the response to 9/11 devolved into the longest war in American history and one of the most disastrous in Afghanistan.
Correct.
And then, what one of the speeches I focus on that I think is really significant is Barack Obama's More Perfect Union speech in 2008, as he accepts the nomination for the Democratic Party to run for president. And it's really hearkening back to those speeches of Lincoln and at Gettysburg and the Declaration of Independence and the whole concept of the American Revolution. He said, "I believe deeply that we cannot solve the challenges of our time unless we solve them together, unless we perfect our union by understanding that we may have different stories, but we hold common hopes, that we may not look the same and may not have come from the same place, but we all want to move in the same direction, towards a better future for our children and our grandchildren. And this belief comes from my undying faith in the decency and generosity of the American people. So Obama's sort of hearkening back to the very principles of the American Revolution.
Yeah, that this piece has stood the test of time a bit, and I think a lot of us long for that to be true again. But I don't know that we're going to get there in the same form. But we hope we can be hopeful, as he says. And then we look at Amanda Gorman, the young poet who spoke at the Biden 2021 inauguration with "The Hill We Climb." Simply put, the new dawn blooms as we free it, for there is always light if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it. So, Bruce, we've looked at these speeches, we have listened to them, and I think we jointly have concurred that the world doesn't have as many great speech writers or speech givers as it once had. But these all do give you cause to think. So let's jump ahead to our own island here in Vashon Events. Our community is not known for violence, and there has been little violence on the island. But what are some Washington or Vashon events that echo these national and recent violent events?
Well, you know, Vashon, as you said, Vashon isn't noted for its violence, but there has been violence on Vashon. You know, not to the extent of sort of the national violence we've talked about here, but certainly back in the late 1940s, when Marion Fitch came to the island and started an illustrated newspaper, basically a photographic newspaper called Island Views. She was a lesbian in a relationship with another woman, and you know, she was met with fairly violent kinds of reactions by the island. Her two dogs were killed and dumped over the bridge at Judd Creek, you know, just in a protest for her lifestyle and for her coming in being this sort of former UW student, you know, former communist, you know, party member, you know, and coming to Vashon and starting a new newspaper.
And again, what year would this have been?
This would have been 1947, 48, okay. So right after World War II. And then a little more than 10 years ago, there was an incident outside of Sporty's in which, you know, an African-American man was attacked by two King County deputies, and Jessica Dwyer, my good friend, jumped on the back of one of the deputies and said, basically, you can't be beating this guy. And of course, she was arrested, and she had to plead guilty, basically, for assaulting a police officer, and got off with a slap of the wrist, basically. But you know, there has been some violence on Vashon, and then you have sort of Vashon speeches, you know, that sort of capture the sense of Vashon, and not so much as speeches as much as sort of phrases, like in the great sort of bridge debate in 1992, you know, placards like, "If you build it, they will come. Don't mercerize Vashon Island. Bridges bring death." I mean, these are sort of great kind of things. And then sort of the quintessential Vashon, you know, the bumper sticker, "Keep Vashon weird." Well, what does that mean? And how weird is Vashon? And how do we keep it weird?
Well, and just as an aside, I had cause to drive to Bellevue just the other day, and crossing the floating bridge, I'm looking at Mercer Island going, wow, that could have been us, because there's a lot of houses over there.
It really could have been. Had the bridge been built, Vashon would look very much like Mercer Island.
So if that were, if that topic, we'll just pick that one out of the group, if that topic were to come up for discussion again now, would it have any different outcome, do you think? You've been here a long time. Do you think we've changed that, would want to put that through, given our frustrations with the Washington State Ferry System?
No, I think islanders like not having a bridge. But, you know, the State Department of Transportation still have the plans. I mean, it's still, the dream is basically to get rid of the ferry system. And, you know, a bridge is one way to do it. And in the long run, you know, if you look at it just as an economic issue, getting rid of the bridge makes, I mean, getting rid of the ferries makes sense. But a bridge is now in the billions of dollars to build, and whether or not there'll ever be the will to build it, you know. I think Vashon's safe for our lifetimes. But then our lifetimes aren't that long, so yeah. You never know.
And that concludes this week's episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us each week for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island heritage. And our programs are available on the Voice of Vashon website at voiceofvashon.org. Go to the site and click on your choice of saved programs. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic, please drop us a note to Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. That's Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a presentation of Voice of Vashon, your island connection. The show is produced by Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services. NACM serves business, credit, and finance departments across the Fruited Plain. We appreciate their support. And with that, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.